Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
You're pitched into this world of fear. Going into a doctor's appointment with a sense of humor as opposed to a sense of dread helped. You're making a lot of decisions in that period, but you're really in a primal place.
Our show is about fixes.
Not the same old left versus right.
I am right,
I'm right.
And you are wrong.
You're wrong.
Yeah, something new. How to make the world a better place.
How do we fix it?
How do we fix it?
Jim, this is a special show to me. My mom died years ago of breast cancer, and my friend Debbie Gallant, who's with us, is living with it.
You know, I think so many people have very intimate experience with this. My mother's a longtime breast cancer survivor.
So we're going to look at Debbie's struggle and the lessons that she's learned over the past few months.
Treatment and diagnosis are a lot better, but we still have a long way to go. About 40,000 American women will die from breast cancer this year. This is How Do We Fix It? I'm Jim Meggs.
I'm Richard Davies.
Debbie Gallant is joining us in the studio. Debbie is the Associate Director of New Media Initiatives at Montclair State University, and she runs the New Jersey News Commons, an effort to support and unite news organizations in the state.
And perhaps even more important, she's the host of a great new podcast, Chemo Files. It's one of our favorites, and here's an excerpt.
Oh. It's like the middle of the night again.
Welcome to the Chemo Files. I'm Debbie Gallant, and here's what 3 a.m. sounds like in my house these days.
It's like the middle of the night again.
That's right. It is like the middle of the night, so.
Right now, this whole sleep thing is pretty weird.
If you go to sleep at 8 o'clock in the evening, it shouldn't surprise anybody that you might be wide awake around 3.
I'm smack in the middle of my 5 months of chemotherapy. I was told from the beginning that, like a law of physics, the side effects of chemo would be cumulative, especially when it came to fatigue. It would add up.
Debbie Gallant, joining us in the studio.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
And Debbie's son, Noah, is also in the studio with us.
Noah's, by the way, the co-producer of the Chemo Files.
Which we're particular fans of. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Debbie, you learned last summer that you had breast cancer. What happened?
I think anybody who gets that call is terrified. And you're pitched into this world of fear, basically this incredible world of fear. And what it reminded me of was in the days following 9/11, where you'd wake up in the morning and you'd have this gut feeling of, oh, no. And that feeling does go away. You think you're going to live with it all that time. But it's hard. You're making a lot of decisions in that period, but you're really in a primal place.
Yeah, I think everybody can relate to this, not maybe in a first-person way, but I think all of us have had some experience with our family. I'm actually, Richard, unlike you, my mother's a longtime breast cancer survivor. So I remember that time almost 40 years ago now when I got that call, flew out to California to be with my mother. She went through that initial period of all the doctor's visits, and things have come a long way since then. When you went through this, what was your first treatment?
I had gone to a particular breast doctor in my town who doesn't take insurance. And I had been to her before. And during that first experience, they're saying, well, you're going to get an MRI and you're going to do this. And even if it's negative, I think we're going to do a surgery. And I felt at that moment that they were churning and that everything was going to be out of pocket.
They were churning. Why?
Because for profit. I mean, I felt like it was all out of network. And I just felt suspicious. And I had and have all along a friend who's a doctor and does holistic medicine, is an internist and acupuncturist. So I would talk to him about things. I ultimately went to the doctor in network who gave very similar advice. So it turned out that the first doctor really wasn't churning, but I felt much better that it was all going to be paid for.
With churning, so you had the suspicion that a lot of tests were going to be ordered up for you that might not be necessary.
And that I was going to have to pay out of pocket for them, yeah. Yeah.
So your first lesson and your first solution, get a second opinion.
Right. And what made me feel comfortable was that the second doctor was saying almost the same things as the first. So as you see consensus, you feel safer. You think, oh, there must be a standard message here, and I am getting the standard conventional wisdom, and everybody agrees.
And what sort of treatment did you get? What was your diagnosis?
Invasive ductal carcinoma with a special kind that's called triple negative, which is more aggressive. You basically have two choices. You can do surgery first and then chemo, or you can do chemo first and then surgery. But you go to a surgeon first. So it seems pretty typical that you get the surgery first. And then there was a decision, lumpectomy versus mastectomy.
Now, when you start getting faced with these decisions, at the early stage, maybe people are agreeing, but then you hit points where not everyone does agree, and you need to start making some of your own decisions or bringing in more people into your team. Do you have a group of people that you consult with before a major decision?
Right. There is a nurse navigator, and that is something that I think is relatively new in the cancer world.
Yeah, tell us about what that is. What is a nurse navigator?
Yeah. So, like, the day after I saw my surgeon, I get this call from this woman, and she goes, I'm your nurse navigator, and I'm here to answer any questions you have about cancer or your treatment. And she was really very nice, and unlike, you know, most doctors, I could actually reach her by regular email. I didn't have to go through
one of those physician
those portals.
Yeah.
And so she really did help clarify things. And I remember right around the time that I was doing this, ProPublica, the investigative network, had just come out with a reading of like every surgeon in the nation. And I looked at my surgeon. I didn't see any problems with him on the thing, but didn't get any deep dive on it either. And they had a thing on what kind of questions to ask. And I saw that he had originally been identified as a general surgeon. So I asked the nurse navigator, it still says on his bio that he's a general surgeon. Is he really a breast surgeon? Has he done dozens of these? Has he done hundreds of these? Has he done thousands of these? You know, mastectomy or lumpectomy? And she said thousands. That was a relief to be able to ask.
What sort of difference does a nurse navigator make to a patient?
This particular one was great. And she also did help me on the decision between lumpectomy and mastectomy. Nobody twisted my arm. And the surgeon basically gave me a choice. The oncologist, who I had seen right before the surgery, was a little bit mysterious. And, you know, after Noah
Levinson, your son, who's with us.
Yeah. And so starting about a month or so into treatment, he started coming with me to my doctor's appointments. And we were able to decode my oncologist and figure out how to talk to him. But it was kind of like a tough source who would just sort of nod at things. And so that very first meeting of him, he seemed to be telling me that I should go for a mastectomy instead of a lumpectomy, but he did it in ways that were not verbal. And so afterwards I was like, wait, what did he say? You know, I wasn't sure. And then when we talked to him the next time, Noah listened back to the tape over and over again, and he found that this guy goes to being a low talker when he says something important, and it kind of, you know, so now I just get very in his face and say, okay, is this your advice that we do this? Right, Noah?
Right, yeah. We had to make him explicit about it.
Right. But when I went back to the nurse navigator, I said to her, what's the deal? Why do some people get mistaken? Because my surgeon had left it basically up to me. He had said if I was BRCA positive, that's a genetic test, we would definitely go for the mastectomy. I wasn't BRCA positive. But she said, look, here's what will happen. if you do a lumpectomy, you'll have mammograms. You'll have lots of tests all your life, and you will have scares, and you will have false positives. And if you have a mastectomy, you're not going to have that. And I just sort of went, okay, sign me up for the mastectomy.
No, I want to ask you, A, was the podcast your idea?
Yeah, the podcast is my idea. When I found out that the chemo was on a certain schedule every 2 weeks, I thought, well, we could do a production schedule like that.
And what's the experience been like of working with your mother?
It's been great. I mean, you know, we sort of all wish it was somebody else's story a little bit. But, I mean, it was really clear in that appointment with the oncologist where we heard these three recommendations for chemotherapy. We listened back to the tape with this idea that we were editing an episode. That was sort of the ethic with which we went into it, and then the conversation morphed into, well, hang on, which chemo are we actually going to get? And it became this tool with which we looked at every aspect of the cancer journey and how to deal with our own confusion and our own feelings about it. Was to articulate them. If you have to make a story for somebody else, it's probably going to become clearer to you what's really going on.
You know, it's so interesting what you say about the oncologist. I've heard this from so many people that, A, I think maybe some people go into that field who are really intrigued by the scientists, and they may be great doctors, but they're maybe not
good communicators
yeah. first.
Huh.
But B, I have this feeling that the medical field is... people are often averse to be perceived as bossing their patients around. They don't want to tell you exactly what to do. And I kind of felt like if I was in that position, I'd be like, tell me what to do. Or at least if I was your son or your brother, what would your recommendation be? And don't give me too many choices.
That's exactly what we asked the doctor. There are a number of different chemotherapies that you can do. And some of them make you lose your hair, and some of them actually don't. And some of them are tougher to take and longer. He presented these three options and said, well, these are all medically reasonable options. But he recommended the third one that he mentioned, which was the harshest treatment.
Right. But he kind of recommended it softly. And in that episode, here's where
this is the episode of Chemophiles.
Right. The episode of my life and of Chemophiles. Noah says, listen very carefully, because this is where I ask him, what would you do if it was somebody in your family? And he says, ACT. And Noah says, you hear? He's saying ACT, which is a regimen, but he's saying it very softly. You know, one of the reasons that particular one was scary, too, was that there was a possibility of heart failure. we were ready for hair loss and stuff like that, but we did. Heart failure was it.
So two things you've said. One is there's just a huge amount of information that you have to consider once you've been diagnosed, right?
Right. At the beginning, when I was really ruled by fear, I was terrified of going on the internet. And I have gained courage as time has gone on, and I found out more. And it's like, if you want to find out more, like basically one of the people I know who has this triple negative is in her third clinical trial, and that was like a light bulb went off. Oh, clinical trials. Oh, how do you find out about that? In my case, nobody's offered them to me, so it's been suddenly researching and squirreling around the web. And then once I started doing that, then I'd stop in on these boards.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And get more information.
Then the other thing that you've said you haven't actually said it, but it's clear, is the importance of family. And your son, Noah, has been through this with you. You've had a chance to discuss this stuff with other people. That must be really important.
Yeah, that definitely is. We go into every appointment talking about what we're going to talk about, because we only get about 10 or 15 minutes at the most. And then we come out of it talking about what we did talk about, what we learned. And
that must be so much more helpful to you than if you had to go through this on your own.
Yeah. And then also the other thing is that I guess the first time in...
She said yes, Noah.
Yes, you've been very helpful. The first time Noah came with me, he had the mic going in the waiting room, and we were really punchy, and he kept turning on record for every funny little thing that we said, and I was like, okay, enough, no, we're going to get kicked out. But I found that punchiness leveled the playing field. Going into a doctor's appointment with a sense of humor as opposed to a sense of dread really, you know, helped.
Yeah, because a lot of people don't have microphones and they're not going to do a podcast. Yeah,
well, actually, right. This raises a really interesting question. I find even as a healthy patient, I go in and talk to the doctor and I come out and my mind's a blank what they said.
Right.
So I usually bring I'm a reporter. I'm used to bringing notebooks. It's probably a good idea for everybody, but maybe for a lot of people, using your phone, recording what the doctor says, you get so little time.
I've heard people doing that who were not podcasters, actually recording and asking permission to record the doctors. None of my doctors were uncomfortable with me recording them. The PR person for St. Barnabas Hospital was uncomfortable with me recording, but the doctors weren't. It's not a bad idea.
So you're going through this great trial. How do you look at the world differently? How do you look at life differently?
Right away, a friend gave me this book, Cancer is a Turning Point. And so you start to think, this game that we play where we think that life is going to go on and on and on forever, and you're kind of pulled out of that. Even if you had the best prognosis, you know, at 95%, you'd still be worried.
Is that all bad? Because my brother died of cancer 10 years ago, an unmitigated tragedy in our family's life. And my response was to buy a second home. To have a little bit more fun in my life than perhaps I would have done, to be a little bit more irresponsible.
I think for me, it's that time is more valuable than money or things. A lot of the recovery was on the porch from the surgery and just savoring that porch time. And because I'm a writer, I did have this sort of epiphany that while I'm sitting there and trying to play the odds on how much time I have left, it made me start thinking about all the experiences I've had. I'm 60. And it's all material, and I want to mine it. I feel like I have a treasure chest to play with as a writer, and that was just a really interesting way of turning it around.
So you haven't bought the Ferrari yet?
No, no Ferrari.
Talk about the importance of humor.
Yeah. Well, it certainly disarms people. I mean, I wrote an essay about the first 48 hours of having cancer, and I said to my husband, should I push the button? Should I publish it? He said, well, you know, you'll get those puppy dog looks. But I did talk to my friend Jeff Jarvis, who is a very public guy, and he said one of the things it will tell people is that you are still Debbie if you've got your voice there. And because I didn't want people walking on eggshells around me. I, you know, didn't want to be this pity case where people were treating me like I was on my deathbed. I'm not there yet. I hopefully won't be there for a long time. But, you know, I'm still... you know, functioning and laughing and you know.
This is not an eggshell question. Talk about your fear of dying.
Yeah, I mean, here's this game that I play on the internet. I play it almost every night. I go on there and I say, what's the survival rate of a stage 1A triple negative breast cancer? And I can't find it. But I cannot find a true answer to this. But it is the scariest question that I can ask. And, I think that the way I think of it now is that I'm able to process the idea that my life may be shorter than I expected, but I'm not really able to envision the deathbed. There could be a recurrence. There could be a metastasis. I've been on boards online where people have it, and they talk about it very matter-of-factly the way I talk about cancer. So I think that that comes first. Like, I don't think I have to... you know, worry about... Well, we do have a very old will. I haven't updated it.
So having cancer plunges you into a relationship with the healthcare industry that most people don't have. What have you learned? What's our medical system doing well? What's not so good?
Well, another thing I learned, and this goes back to the internet, is that my doctor, particularly an oncologist, he treats all kinds of cancer. So he's not on the lookout for every triple negative breast cancer research or breakthrough that there is. So if I want that, I have to go seek it out. But on the other hand, I'm heartened by the fact there's a lot of research going on. And if you do have a diagnosis that's a little bit worse, that's where the research is focused.
How we screen for breast cancer is highly controversial, and one of your podcasts really dealt with this. And a national task force, for instance, has called for women to wait until the age of 50 to begin screening for breast cancer. What's your take on the debate?
Well, Noah and I have different takes on this.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
So from the individual's point of view, I know that if I had waited the 2 years, which is what they were recommending after 55, they would have found my fast-growing cancer a year later. And that would have been bad for me. But Noah, you can talk about...
Noah, what's your take?
Well, she's right. In her individual case, this mammogram may well have saved her life, which makes it... It's really hard to think in these massive numbers, because for our episode where we dealt with this mammogram debate just weeks after the American Cancer Society had come out scaling back its own recommendations for mammograms, we talked to people who really were invested in the pure science. A lot of people think that everyone on the side of less screening, that it's always budget hawks. But the person we talked to, Dr. Michael Baum, he implemented screening hubs in the UK back in the 80s. He sat on the National Screening Committee, and his research in the last 20 years has led him to this conclusion that the amount of overdiagnosis and false diagnosis of precancers, things that could become cancer, that are getting treated before that happens, exposes massive numbers of women to a risk that he doesn't think is justified.
And that risk is usually radiation.
And that's been a big issue for men in terms of prostate cancer. They can find it very early, but if it's slow-growing cancer, maybe you're better off not knowing it's there.
Right.
I have to say, personally, I think I'd rather know.
And I agree with you. I would rather know, too. But that once people have cancer, they want to do everything. Mm-hmm. So they don't act rationally. They act out of fear. There's a lot going on out of fear.
So let's talk about solutions. And there was a wonderful episode of your Chemo Files about the sisterhood. Yeah. Tell us about the sisterhood.
The cancer sisterhood is amazing, you know, and I discovered it very early when, because I was so public. And if you're not public, you're not going to necessarily benefit from it as much, because it was the fact that I did a blog post, and people from all parts of the Facebook and the internet came to me who had had cancer. So I put it out there, and from that came people who I barely knew, who I didn't know, who'd had breast cancer, and who said, I'm here to help you. There was a woman named Bunny who came to me because the original doctor had asked her to call me. She called me at work, and she was a complete stranger, and she totally calmed me down. And then I've had that opportunity to do that with other people as well. And sometimes it's really kind of trivial stuff, and sometimes it's existential, emotional stuff and the handholding, and sometimes it's really critical medical information.
A little closer to home, any advice for how to involve your family, how to lean on people that are closest to you?
Oh, boy. You need a lot of luck to have a good family that is able to listen. I was very happy that Noah decided to come home. And I think that's actually fairly common.
Yeah, I came home when my mother had cancer.
Yeah. I mean, I felt a little bit guilty, but it was like a bonus prize to be able to get all this time with him.
Give your best argument for being a self-advocate.
Who else is going to advocate for you,
exactly.
You know? I mean, you know, but you have to come from a place of knowledge and self-knowledge about your body, too.
Yeah, yeah. And you don't necessarily have to be a journalist or a professional to have that. I mean, it's about the ability to question the people
but
in white coats.
It does take confidence.
Or maybe even have a family member there at doctor's appointments being an advocate for you.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So, Noah, what have you learned about your mother through this process?
Well, she's a very good journalist, and I'm trying to break into journalism and radio. So we write a script for each episode, and the first time we sat down together and said, okay, well, we pretty much understand the story, let's write out the words, it probably took us 15 hours, or some ridiculous amount of of hand-wringing over phrasing and over which quote was important and what was taking up too much time. And we have, over these last, five or six episodes, have really become much better collaborators. I've learned so much.
Debbie Gallant and your son, Noah Levinson, 22, right?
23.
Okay. Thanks very much for joining us on How Do We Fix It?
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
So, Richard, both of us come to the show with a lot of personal baggage and experience. In my case, much happier than yours. But yeah. I found it just really moving to sit here with Debbie and Noah and hear their experiences as they're still in the thick of it.
Yeah, and I think that what it underlines for me is the importance of work, family, and humor, especially her humor. So often with cancer and with other tragedies, it's hard to talk to people because you feel you can't make a joke. And I think that just listening to Debbie talk about it with so much humor is hopefully helpful.
Yeah, a couple of things that really jumped out at me. One is she's very public about it. And I think she wouldn't say that's for everybody.
No.
But I think it's something that really works for her. And I've seen this in a number of people in my circle who've been through this, that being public helps rally the support. And I think maybe it's somewhat liberating for the patient.
Yeah, one of the things we're going to do with Debbie between now, the recording, and when we release this show is to put on our website some advocacy and help organizations. If you've been listening to this and you want to know more, that'll be on our website, which is howdowefixit.me.
The other big thing, of course, is to be your own advocate, to do the research. And I was intrigued by this idea of recording the interviews with the doctors. I've heard so many people saying that their oncologist wasn't the greatest communicator or wasn't as clear as they wanted. Making sure that you have that record of exactly what he or she is saying, I think is really valuable for people with all kinds of medical conditions.
Yeah, and most people have smartphones, and they're very easy to find the recording devices on those. That's not a difficult thing to do.
And the final thing for me is I was just very touched by the relationship between Debbie and Noah and the idea of him coming home and creating this wonderful podcast out of this shared experience.
And then also the sisterhood. I think a lot of women, and I won't make vast generalizations, but a lot of women, I think, have deeper, richer friendships than men do, especially when they're talking about their bodies and their emotions.
I think that's probably true. It'd be interesting to get, a prostate cancer survivor in to see what that experience is like.
Yeah, maybe we'll do that in a future show.
Something to look forward to.
Yeah. Okay, this is How Do We Fix It.
I'm Jim Meggs.
I'm Richard Davies. Our producer, Miranda Schaefer. And the music is by Luz Travinsky. You're listening to it right now.
How Do We Fix It is recorded at Mono Lisa Studios in beautiful Uptown Manhattan. Our audio engineer is Denise Barbarita.
And the show is produced by Davies Content. We make digital audio for companies and nonprofits. Thanks for joining us.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford Tough, Built Ford Proud.